loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The United States has announced that it will commence with a military operation to take Raqqa in Syria from the so-called Islamic State before the end of the battle to retake Mosul in Iraq. But first comes the battle to see who will take part in the battle. Iceland's parliamentary elections take place on Saturday with a relatively new political force called the Pirate Party, expected to do well or even win. The party wants to grant Edward Snowden citizenship and advocates a platform of direct democracy. As Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen that was launched in March 2015 continues to drag on, Western countries continue to sell the Saudi government arms despite the pleas of human rights organizations. What does the conflict in Yemen mean for the wider region and the world? But first we turn to Iraq. The United States has announced that it will commence with an operation to take Raqqa in Syria from the so-called Islamic State before the end of the battle to retake Mosul in Iraq. But first comes the battle to see who will take part in the battle. We are joined from Paris by Pepe Escobar, writer and political analyst. Welcome back, Pepe.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Pepe, on Wednesday, the U.S. commander in Syria and Iraq, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, said the U.S. had a sense of urgency, those are his words, to launch an operation to take Raqqa from the so-called Islamic State. But do we know who is supposed to be involved in this operation? If the U.S. provides air cover, who will the forces be on the ground? And has this issue even been resolved?
Of course not. They don't know what they are doing. In fact, they could have launched an operation to take Raqqa 2 years ago, a year ago, 6 months ago. Why now? It's because Ashkar is going to lose his job in 3 months. It's because the Pentagon is going to be a headless Pentagon in 3 months. They don't know. And the Battle of Mosul is not going to be concluded in the next few weeks, especially in this past 3 or 4 days. They were at advancing steadily because they were far away from. Now that they are getting closer to Mosul, there are some units that are like 4 or 5 kilometers from Mosul. And it's going to be an absolute nightmare. It's going to be practically a man-to-man battle. This could go on for months, in fact. So it's completely absurd to think about taking over Raqqa, especially because we already have a heady mix in the Battle of Mosul. And the Battle of Raqqa will be an even headier mix, especially because it's going to take place in Syria. And obviously, the Syrian Arab army will want to get into Raqqa themselves and not a bunch of foreigners or Kurds or American special forces.
Yes, you can see how that would undoubtedly and inevitably be the case, that there would be contention about who would actually be the military forces. Ash Carter, the Secretary of Defense in charge of the Pentagon for the Obama administration, he's pretty ambiguous about who the different forces are. He talks about pro-U.S. elements. He mentions the Kurds, the YPG, who have been fighting along with U.S. commando units. But I want to read to you a dispatch and a quote that he gave to CBS News. It starts in the next few weeks, referring to the timeline for an assault led by Arab and Kurdish forces on ISIS Syrian stronghold of Raqqa. That has long been our plan, and we will be capable of resourcing both. He added, it's been a long part of our plan that the Mosul operation would kick off when it did. This was a plan that goes back many months now, and that Raqqa would follow soon behind. Now, at the same time, they're talking about a sense of urgency because they say they have intelligence reports that from Raqqa, new foreign external terrorist operations are being planned by ISIS. In other words, perhaps outside the Middle East. But when you hear the whole thing, Pepe, what you're saying is these are just a bunch of words. In other words, they have no meaning.
No, they have no meaning whatsoever. First of all, because the Aleppo-Raqqa-Mosul connection is very important. Mosul is encircled in three different angles, but there's nothing encircling Mosul from the west. And guess what happened? Because the Iraqi forces and the Americans, for a few months, they were telegraphing the Battle of Mosul. So what happened with the key leaders of ISIS, Daesh? They left via the west to the Syrian desert. Many of them to Raqqa and many of them to some villages in the middle of nowhere, but in the eastern Syrian desert. So this should have been closed from the beginning. And now we have some Iraqi Shiite militias, in fact, trying to close this avenue from western Mosul to Raqqa. It may be too late in terms of capturing the leaders of ISIS. They can capture a bunch of jihadists, let's put it this way, but that's not enough. So the Americans and the Iraqis, on purpose, left this avenue open, thinking long term that, if they are all concentrated in Raqqa, the leadership, then we can attack them later. But once again, with whom? The YPG, everybody knows that. In fact, we've known that for months. The YPG, they don't have the numbers to attack Raqqa, encircle and attack and control Raqqa by themselves. You would need at least 50,000, 60,000 troops to do that. And that for me is the key problem. The only ones who would have enough numbers would be the Syrian Arab Army. But it's completely crazy when the head of the Pentagon is telling the world that they are going to reconquer Raqqa, which is inside Syrian territory that is controlled by Damascus, technically, officially, and in UN terms, in fact. And they're going to do it with what? A bunch of expat troops and infiltrated forces. It's completely absurd.
The YPG are the Kurdish units. That's the Kurdish Protection People's Units. And they have been fighting along with the United States. You also have Turkey, the Turkish military inside of both Syria and in Iraq. Of course, during the Ottoman Empire, Aleppo and Mosul were part of the Ottoman Empire. Turkey under Erdogan has sort of grand regional designs, perhaps the glory days again of the Ottoman Empire. How does the U.S. view the Turkish role? And do you believe that along with the Kurdish YPG units, This seems so contradictory that the U.S. would actually countenance the idea of Turkey being part of the liberation of Raqqa, so-called?
Exactly. And that's the problem, because the Washington, they don't want to jeopardize the already very fractious relationship with Erdogan, the AKP, and Ankara. At the same time, they are supporting the YPG Kurds. They support the Peshmerga in Iraq, which is Iraqi Kurds, practically, they are in fact autonomous vis-a-vis Baghdad. That enrages Baghdad a lot. But the Peshmerga count on active American special forces support. This Peshmerga part of the offensive against Mosul, we have American special forces infiltrated and even American medics infiltrated. There are plenty of images everywhere of American medics that went there because they are protected by American forces as well. In a series more complicated because they support the IPG, but they cannot let the IPG go running rampant all over because it's a direct clash against the Kurds. The Turks. The Turks' priority, it comes in many colors, no-fly zone, safe zone. But in fact, Erdogan stopped talking about a no-fly zone. Now he's talking about a safe zone. And the safe zone is along the northeast Turkish-Syrian border. And that is not very far from Raqqa, by the way. So we're going to have Turkish forces north of Raqqa along the border. They will be fighting against YPGs, and some of them will have to contribute with this offensive against Raqqa. So you see, we will have maybe two different battles, a battle to reconquer Raqqa and a battle between the IPGs and the Kurds along the border. It's completely crazy.
Yeah. And you have, of course, the United States intertangled on both sides. Pepe Escobar, as you said, the United States is supporting the Kurds, the YPG, the People's Protection Units. Those units are part of the Kurdish movement, and the Kurdish movement wants either autonomy or complete independence in the northern part of Syria. The Turkish government is, of course, part of And Turkey is part of NATO. It is the eastern flank of NATO. It is the second largest military in NATO. It is still, even though there's frayed relations, a U.S. ally. And the Turks see within the Kurds, especially the Kurds in Syria, any accomplishment of their goal of autonomy to be a catalyst for or a signal that the Kurds, who are much more numerous in southeast Turkey, could also become autonomous. And so the Turks have as their primary objective to defeat any aspirational Kurdish autonomous zone. So you have America fighting with Turkey as an ally of NATO, America fighting with the Kurds fighting with Turkey, Turkey fighting with the Kurds, and you have the Syrian and you have the Syrian Arab Army, which will consider a Turkish incursion and an American incursion into Syria to take Raqqa on the eastern part of Syria to be an act of foreign aggression, obviously, because they would, if they captured Raqqa, not allow that territory to go back to the central government of Damascus, but it would become an extension of either Turkish or American or both power. And then you have Turkey, because of its frayed relations with the United States, trying to mend fences with Russia, and Russia is supporting the Turkish and the Syrian Arab Army. I mean, when you look at that boiling pot, I mean, it seems impossible for anyone to make heads or tails out of it, much less carry out a competent military move on the capital of the caliphate, Raqqa, where I would guess there are tens of thousands of fighters.
Yes, Brian, that's very well put. You framed it very well, in fact. And in fact, it's beyond surrealist what's going on in terms of foreign interference, in terms of loss of sovereignty, in terms of playing factions against each other, in terms of playing Turks against Kurds and Sunnis against Shiites. It's a real mess. What we should consider is the motivations of the key players. So let's start with Erdogan. Erdogan, they made a deal. Erdogan and Putin made a deal. We don't know the exact contours of the deal. What we do know is that he renounced of having any role whatsoever in Aleppo. So this used to be one of Erdogan's main planks, in fact. So now he forgot about Aleppo, but the trade-off was, okay, we don't interfere with Aleppo. East Aleppo may be reconquered by the Syrian Arab Army, by Syrian aviation, Russian Air Force, but we want our safe zone along the Turkish-Syrian border because, of course, the number one priority for Erdogan and Ankara is any possibility of a Syrian Kurd autonomous zone, which will be part of a greater Kurdistan later on. It's complicated. It's even more complicated because they have no relationship whatsoever with the YPG, which they consider a branch of the PKK.
And the PKK, for our listeners, is the Kurdistan Workers Party, which has been fighting in Turkey on behalf of the very large Kurdish population there. Go ahead.
Absolutely. At the same time, Erdogan has a very good relationship with Erbil, with the Barzani government in the Kurdistan Regional Government, with the Peshmerga.
That's in Iraq.
Yeah, in Iraq. But we cannot forget that Kurdistan in Iraq is not homogeneous and controlled only by Barzani. Barzani controls, let's say, 50-60% of Kurdistan. The other 40% is controlled by another party, which is inimical to Barzani interests. They control Suleimania, for instance. And so there is not an homogeneous Kurdish position. The Kurds are masters at fighting themselves and fighting each other. We all know that historically. So there is an internal mess in Iraqi Kurdistan. But in Syria Kurdistan, the YPG are more or less unified. And their support by the PKK is very, very strong. In Iraqi Kurdistan, the PKK, they are refugees in some mountains, in Sinjar Mountains, for instance. And they play no role because it's an inter-Kurdish problem that's the heart of Iraqi Kurdistan. So what Erdogan wants is to have this safe zone along the border, prevent the Syrian Kurds, the YPG, from uniting three cantons along the border. Two of them in the northeast are more or less united. If they would unite with another canton in the more to the west called Afrin, then we would have, if you look at the map, we would have the map of a Syrian Kurdistan practically. This for Erdogan and for Ankara is absolute anathema. No way. So how could they contribute to the battle in Raqqa if they will be fighting against the Syrian Kurds? Impossible. So the Americans can only count on the YPG, in fact. And they could count on Free Syrian Army units that are not completely absorbed by Al-Qaeda. This is a fiction. It will be probably, what, a few hundred. And they need tens of thousands for an offensive against Raqqa. So, and on top of it, as you explained before, the Syrian Arab army is completely excluded from this offensive to take Raqqa. Which brings us to the motivation of the American motivation, in fact. Very important. What the Pentagon would like is what that famous leaked report 2012 of the Defense Intelligence Agency actually said. It was written, it's on, and now it's on the record. A Salafist principality in eastern Syria. To have that, they can have or not have Raqqa. If Raqqa is part of it, of parts of Raqqa, of part of it, but the whole of eastern Syria is still in turmoil and with scattered Islamic Daesh fighters all over the place, that suits the American purpose, which is to keep Damascus in check and obviously an absolute interference with Damascus sovereignty over their own territory. So Syria is already dismembered, in fact. If they keep Western Syria, which is the Syria that works, that access from Damascus, Homs, Hama, and Aleppo. And if they conquer East Aleppo, which is something that they could do in the next few, I would say, weeks, but 2 or 3 months, then they have the Syria that works. The problem is, it's not going to be the Syria as we know it. Most of the territory, eastern Syria, which is nothing, it's desert. 2 or 3 villages, two big cities, and a lot of desert. It's going to be the Salafist principality. And then the Americans will have the perfect excuse to be fighting ISIS for the next 10, 20, 50 years, in fact. So this is the American master plan.
I see. Okay. Hey, B. Escobar, we are completely out of time. We've been talking about this so-called pending offensive in Raqqa or whatever it will be. We're glad to have you back, Pepe Escobar. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. And clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Iceland's parliamentary elections takes place on Saturday with a relatively new political force called the Pirate Party, expected to do well or even win. The party wants to grant Edward Snowden citizenship and advocates a platform of direct democracy. We are joined from Iceland by a member of Iceland's Pirate Party, Octavia Hirond. She is a candidate for parliament running for the second seat in the South constituency, and by Jose Tirado, a Puerto Rican poet and political writer living in Iceland. Welcome, Octavia and Jose.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Octavia, let's start by talking about the background of your party, a relatively new party making a lot of waves because you came from almost nowhere, what was considered to be a fringe movement, but now it's possible that you could actually be the front runner in the parliamentary election. When was it founded? Why was it founded, and what does it advocate?
So the Pirate Party in Iceland was founded about 3.5 years ago. The movement itself is 10 years old and stems out of Sweden. But here in Iceland, we've been a party for approximately 3.5, almost 4 years. The last 3 years, since 2013, we've had 3 members in Parliament, so a very, very small party there. And right now we're looking at probably having 15. So we've grown expansively in the last couple of years. I think the main 2 things that the Pirate Party stands for is transparency in governance and advocating for privacy and updating laws to better fit the 21st century.
Iceland went through a very major economic crisis as a consequence of the 2007-2008 global economic meltdown that began right here in Wall Street. Talk about the Pirate Party's economic program. And also, would you consider yourself an anti-establishment party, and how do the establishment parties view you?
I think we're definitely viewed as an anti-establishment movement. Some of the things behind that is we want the constitution that the Icelandic people voted on in 2012 to come into effect as soon as possible. And other than that, we've refused to collaborate with the current government parties because of corruption and because their involvement in corruption, which came out very clearly in the Panama Papers. So in certain ways, we could definitely be viewed as anti-establishment. In terms of after the economic crash, the Pirates were formed out, in a sense, out of the movement that happened after that. And so it was the crowdsourced constitution that we voted on in 2012. The Pirate Party itself does not take direct money from any lobby organizations nor companies. We launched our own crowdsourcing campaign about a month ago once the elections were confirmed. And so if any companies do want to donate money to us, they would have to do so through a crowdsourcing platform, making it impossible, very difficult for us to know which companies or which individuals actually donate to us. So in a sense, we're a party grown off the internet that is still very active on the internet, as we don't have the same amount of funds to be able to campaign on traditional platforms.
Jose Tirado, that's really amazing. Crowdsource the Constitution. I mean, it's hard to kind of even wrap your head around that, at least here. But last year, you wrote in Counterpunch that the quote, and I'm quoting your words, the two center-right parties' funding comes primarily from the owners of the country, the fishing sea barons, and the large agricultural interests. Give us a sense of Iceland's political economy. Who really runs the country? And could this election change the existing status quo on the economic front?
I don't think so for the latter. I think context matters. And I think one of the things that needs to be remembered here is that Iceland is a small country of about 325,000 people. And what that means is that it's basically a country of cousins. And so you have people who have traditionally owned resources, shipping companies, ships themselves, fishing processing plants, for example, or the large agricultural combines that helped form the Progressive Party back in the days when it really was a bit progressive. And those families have married off into the general population, if you will, which is actually not all that large. And so change is very slow to come in Iceland. So no, I don't think, to the second part of your question, that there's going to be a remarkable change in terms of the economic status. The owners of the country will remain the owners, I believe. However, the Pirates are at the cusp of a very large, disenfranchised, and upset population. People who, in my conversations at least, are frankly more concerned with housing issues than privacy issues. Nevertheless, this widespread dissatisfaction is revolutionary in potential. And so I think what Octavia was saying about the Constitution, I think that is primary. If, in fact, the Pirates take the majority on Saturday, which I think is going to be the case, and if they can push through with an alliance of the three other parties that they talked about in their press conference today, then and if they push through this constitution, there will be sea changes, but they will be long in coming. And I think the number one thing they're going to need to do is to survive past a single term. And I think that's going to be tough because there's a lot of interest. I've talked to sailors, I've talked to shipping people, and they're actually scared. They know that their sails will be trimmed a little bit if some of these reforms get passed. And they're worried. And I think they'll fight back. And because of this thing of the country of cousins that I mentioned earlier, it's very difficult for people to too vocally criticize others because, in fact, you're probably going to be insulting somebody who's related to your aunt or your uncle, somebody who's married to someone you know, an old friend. And so there seems to be this wait and see attitude. And however, the after the economic crisis in 2008, so many people suffered, and so many people lost their savings and lost out on anything on the country in terms of benefits, except for, of course, the owners of the country, that people were disgusted. and they've had several governments since, and nothing has worked, and I think that's why they're jumping ship and jumping with the pirates.
Octavia, do you agree with Jose's characterization of Iceland?
To a certain extent. I mean, I'm not popular with all my cousins, I'll tell you that. We are a small nation, and yes, we are a cousin nation, I think, as was told. On the other hand, I think that the time is ripe for change, and I see a lot of courage. Yes, it is difficult. Yes, people are scared, but that's what change is about, to have the courage to actually change the status quo. Now, in terms of the economics of things, we have sailors within the party. I mean, the Pirate Party really encompasses the entire nation. So we have people like myself who come home after spending a lot of time abroad that are ready to help influence the future. We have young people, we have Pirates Plus 60. I mean, so we have a pretty broad sense of the things that people have an interest in. Now, the way that the pirates have gone about looking at what is most important for the people is by asking the people, and by, within our own party, having very many direct democracy processes that does allow for more influence. I think that is the most beautiful thing also about our constitution, that it also sets up a direct democracy. Now, as mentioned today, we did have a press conference, and we will be working together with other political parties if we are mandated to form government. However, I think the Constitution is at the forefront, but the way in which we open up the conversation is even more important. I've worked a lot in countries with repression, with silencing techniques. I'm ready, and I think the pirates are ready to open up, to have that difficult conversation at the dinner table, in public, within Parliament. So I think perhaps I'm a little bit more optimistic. But I absolutely agree. Many of my own family members are within the Independence Party, and they're definitely not happy about the fact that I'm running and will probably get into Parliament for the Pirates.
Octavia and Jose, I want to just ask you, what's the end goal, economically speaking, for the Pirate Party? Because you obviously have an emphasis on process. You have an emphasis on participation, an emphasis on transparency. But you yourself, either as the party, Octavia, or as an individual, how do you see it ending up? Because property is either publicly owned or it's privately owned. The banks are either privately owned, they're either privately connected investment banks, or they're nationalized public property. I mean, how do you see it, and what's necessary for Iceland? In other words, is there, in addition to the process issues, the democratization issues, does the party have like a socialist sort of fundamental orientation in terms of the economy, or is it a capitalist orientation?
In the manifesto, the Pirate Party's manifesto for these parliamentary elections, they have a phrase in there that says they wish to, one of their platforms is an auctioning of a share of the shipping quota to the highest bidders. And I think that's going to replicate, the shipping quota is the allotment that certain groups have for owning a percentage of the profits of the fish that are extracted in the oceans nearby. If this idea of perhaps trying to break up these monopolies, if you will, and selling portions of it to the highest bidder is still feeding into a very capitalist idea that the highest bidder is not going to be the plumber that I talk to who's got all kinds of difficulties and can't, you know, has medical difficulties, what do you call it? His rent is too high. Or for single mother, for example, here in the town that I live in Hafnarfjörður, these are people who aren't going to be the highest bidders and are going to benefit from the breakup of the quota system. They're not going to have a say in that, and they're not going to get a piece of it. It's going to be the same people. So I'm that's where I'm very skeptical, and that's a major issue.
Okay, Octavia, go ahead.
I disagree with that. I think the way in which the free market within the fishing industry will work will actually allow us to, for instance, drastically improve our healthcare system and actually make it more or less free. So the plumber that you mentioned would actually directly benefit. The part of this that's important is within the new constitution that we're hopefully going to pass as soon as possible, natural resources belong to the Icelandic people, and the Icelandic people can sell, can auction that off to the highest bidder. The money that is right now in the fishing industry is huge for this country, and most of it is going on very few hands, as Jose says. With the changing of that system, with the changing of many of these processes and making them more effective, making them more transparent, allowing for the cousin nation to actually see who benefits from what, I think we will be able to enrich the and or effectively set forth the welfare system that we want and that Icelanders deserve. So in that case, I want to say that that's just the beginning. I think we are a wealthy nation when it comes to resources, and the way in which we can capitalize of that as a people is not as far-fetched.
Go ahead, Jose. Jump in.
I just wanted to caution that expropriating wealth from the wealthy is far more difficult in practice than it is on paper. And I don't see the, 12 or 13% of the population that owns more than 50% of the wealth in this country as giving up their ownership or their what they consider their God-given rights to the fish quota system willingly or easily. So I think it's going to be far more difficult to do than has just been described.
Go ahead, Octavia.
No, absolutely. I'm very related to a lot of those people. So I'm not saying it's going to be easy. I know my cousins, but nevertheless, I think the stubbornness of the Icelandic people, the courage that we're seeing now, the Icelandic Pirate Party, no matter how large or small a group of people are going to be in parliament, are going to have their hands full for a very long time. No doubt about that. These are not changes that should or can be done overnight. So I think we're ready for the long haul, I guess, is the final statement from me on that.
We have 2 minutes left. Let's talk about Edward Snowden. You're offering citizenship if you become the ruling party to Edward Snowden. What would that mean? Would he accept? And just talk about that, if you would. And how popular is Edward Snowden in Iceland?
How popular is Ed? I think he's as popular here as he is in most other Western countries to a certain extent, except the U.S., where he really does divide the country. I think he is popular because of the way in which the courage that he showed, the revelations that he brought forth, and what that reveals. I think we're in a new information age, which isn't that new anymore, but the courage that people show in the way that they bring forth and break down and confirm what we already know and talk about in terms of what government is allowed or not allowed to do is very important, and it's very important to the Icelandic people. The Pirate Party will continue its policy on offering citizenship, but he needs to get here. So that's kind of the catch. But yes, it would be quite something, I think.
Go ahead, Jose.
It's an issue. The Snowden issue, I think, is a small one in terms of what is important for the future of Iceland. I think the ownership of resources is a far bigger one, and I think that's the one that it's going to make or break the party come Saturday.
Octavia, we have 30 seconds. Quick question. If you get the majority, will you seek an alliance with the Left Green Party, for example? Would you make an alliance with any other party in order to become the ruling party?
I think as the people that were at the press conference said today, we will be able to form a coalition with the Left Green Bright Future and the Social Democrats. So let's just see how the terms are and how much trust the Icelandic people show us come Saturday.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking to Octavia Hirón. She is a candidate for parliament running for the second seat in the South constituency on the Pirate Party. And we've been talking with Jose Tirado, poet and a political writer living in Iceland. We are out of time. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. As Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen that was launched in March 2015 continues to drag on, Western countries continue to sell the Saudi government arms despite the pleas of human rights organizations. Are the goals of Saudi Arabia in Yemen the same as those of the United States and the UK? And what does the conflict in Yemen mean for the wider region and the world? We are joined by Catherine Shakdam. She is a political analyst focusing on the Middle East and the author of a new book, A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Welcome back, Catherine.
Thank you very much for having me. And yes, to your first question, I would say a grand no. I don't think, do you know, this war in Yemen has been sold by Saudi Arabia as a war of political restoration, as they have, you know, sold the world this idea that President Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, who was elected in a very farcical, you know, democratic elections, it was actually a one-man election in 2012, you know, is said to be represented the constitutional legitimacy of Yemen, but that's not even the case because he, as I said, he was elected in a one-man election, which is hardly democratic at all. And he is part of the deep state. He was part of the regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh for 33 years. So he's hardly, you know, a reformer, hardly someone you would say has an interest in actually trying to improve the democratic institution of his country. If anything, he was part of the problem. And he actually was elected for 2 years. So, you know, his mandate ended in 2014 and we are 2016 and we are, still being told this story that he's the one who should come back, even though the people clearly don't want him, you know, but that's the first thing. The second thing, I mean, you just have to look at the wanton destruction, the systematic targeting of civilian infrastructures. You know, might it be schools, hospitals, you know, crops, farms, livestock, industries, hospitals, mosques, museums, you name it, they have destroyed it. There is a clear desire, and this has been actually noted by not just the UNESCO, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, Doctors Without Borders, and countless other NGOs, and I would say, you know, international observers, that there has been a systematic desire to annihilate Yemen, you know, social construct, historical past, religious makeup. It's called, you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's a genocide which is ongoing in the Yemen. And of course, people are looking the other way because who cares about an impoverished nation in Saudi Arabia when the mighty, you know, all rich Saudi Arabia is actually commanding the international community to, you know, to destroy this nation so that they could assert, you know, their power. And they have actually threatened, and I would say, holds the international community ransom. You know, we have seen this first with the United Nations when, you know, the Secretary General was actually forced to backtrack on his, you know, reprimand of Saudi Arabia human rights track records. And then it happened again, you know, with the very famous 9/11 law. You know, the Saudi threatened Washington, you know, through economic warfare. And of course, you know, we all know what happened. There's been a lot of backpedaling, you know, backtracking and trying to kind of assuage Riyadh. But no one is speaking for Yemen.
Yeah, that's the voice of Catherine Shakdam. She is the author of a new book, A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. Catherine, I want to talk to you about your book. The general population, certainly here in the United States, where, of course, the United States is a primary backer of Saudi Arabia, along with the UK, U.S. government that speaks in the name of the American people, sells the Saudi government huge amounts of weapons. They recently sent, I think, $100 million of weapons. The U.S. is coordinating militarily with Saudi's war against the people of Yemen. A couple of weeks ago, a funeral home was bombed by Saudi Arabia. 140-plus people were killed, hundreds more wounded. That was a targeted killing because leaders of the Houthi movement were actually present. This is a story that the American people don't really fully understand, of course, because they get most of their information from the mainstream media. So I want to ask you about your book, A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. First of all, why did you write the book? What's the general theme of the book? What are you trying to accomplish with this latest publication of yours?
I'm trying to tell the truth about Yemen's war and what actually the Yemeni people want to see, you know, happen in their country. It's basically, I'm kind of, you know, reframing this war in Yemen and explaining that it's not what the people were told. It has nothing to do, you know, with political legitimacy. It has nothing to do with even democracy. You know, this war has been a long time coming because there have been, you know, dynamics at play already since the 1960s when, you know, in 1964, Yemen attempted a grand revolution to try to kind of reform its institution and establish itself as a republic. But you have to understand this happening, you know, during the time of pan-Arabism and, you know, Abdel Nasser in in Egypt. And so this is when this grand battle actually took place in between, I would say, you know, a Republican movement, a transnational Republican movement, you know, versus the Gulf monarchies. And this has terrified Saudi Arabia ever since. And so it has tried since to kind of turn Yemen into a nation satellite, if you wish, you know, a colony of Saudi Arabia. The problem is 2012 kind of precipitated those, you know, those dynamic and the desire that the people have had in Yemen to live free. You know, when I talk about this tale of grand resistance, you have to look at the Houthis today, not just as this tribal faction from northern Yemen, but I would say the carrier of a popular will. The people of Yemen are tired to live under the thumb of Al Saud. They are tired to live under the thumb of Wahhabism, with people in Riyadh telling them what to think, what, how to pray and what to believe. They want to return to their traditions. They want to be able to choose for themselves what future they want to have. They want to be able to leave their tradition and remember their history and their national identity away from Western powers, away from foreign diktat. It's very simple. And the problem that we have is that I don't understand why, for example, the US and West and the Western world in general cannot grasp the fact that what Yemen is actually calling for, you know, calling for is the natural right to resist against tyranny. And this is what we're talking about. So when we're looking at America, for example, which resisted against, you know, the British Empire and actually forged its very nationality under this idea that people have the right to resist unlawful and illegitimate rule, well, they're not giving the same courtesy to the Yemeni people. And all the Yemeni are asking is for the right to their own democracy. They're asking for the right to be free.
Catherine, let me ask you, when Yemen was divided into two between the North and South Yemen, as you said, between the Republican movement and the part still perhaps dominated by the Saudis in the 60s, the Southern part was led by a communist movement, a socialist movement. Talk about that.
Well, it didn't happen like that, because at the time in the 1960s, South Yemen was still under, you know, British rule. So the North Yemen was very different from South Yemen. It just became united in the 1990s. So it's very different. South Yemen in the 1990s had no religious identity as such. And so the Wahhabis were very able to influence a lot South Yemen, which is why today you see the likes of Al-Qaeda and Daesh, you know, being very, I would say, alive in the South, because, again, Saudi Arabia managed to imprint its religious makeup onto the South Yemen. The same thing is, you know, cannot be said of North Yemen. North Yemen is, you know, historically very free and very moderate Islam, in that they actually don't have anything related to sectarianism. You find a lot of Sunni and Sufis and Zaydi and Shia. There's a lot of different currents, religious currents in Yemen, in northern Yemen, and people were quite happily living side by side. It's only with the influence of Saudi Arabia, you know, since the 1990s, you know, beginning of 1964, when it started to, you know, slowly kind of embed itself in the Yemeni society, that we have seen this kind of this emergence of terror movement. And what is terrifying is that if you look at the geopolitics of Yemen, Yemen sits on the world oil route, which would mean that if Yemen was to fall to Saudi Arabia, which I talk about in my book, then you would essentially give Saudi Arabia a grand monopoly on oil security. Can you imagine having to actually live under the diktat of one theocracy, the most violent in the world, you know, and having actually Western power, you know, so-called democracies, you know, actually enabling, you know, this kind of regime to actually become super powerful in a world completely and solely dependent on oil. And, you know, it's insane to me, you know, to see democracy enabling the likes of Saudi Arabia against the Yemeni people just because they want to live free. I mean, you know, if I could make another parallel, I mean, the same thing happened in 1979 in Iran when the Iranian people tried to establish a republic. Maybe not the one that the West wanted to see arise, but, you know, nevertheless, a republic against the Shah of Iran, who was a despot. You know, and they chose to help the despot against a republic. And then the same thing is happening again in Yemen. But it is very dangerous to see this happening today in the Middle East when we know that we have a radical problem when we know we have a Wahhabi problem in the world, in Syria, in Iraq. You know, you could see it happening, you know, in Egypt and in Libya and in Afghanistan. I mean, there are countless countries today falling to the like of Saudi Arabia. We cannot afford to lose Yemen. And the Yemeni people are fighting desperately, you know, to have their voices heard. They are fighting Saudi Arabia because there is no other way for them forward. And the only way forward for them is actually through Saudi Arabia. They have to depose this regime. They have to denounce the tyranny of the House of Saud, you know, to be able to live free. And the saddest part is that everyone is actually enabling, you know, this grand genocide in Saudi Arabia, and no one is speaking for the Yemeni people. And so I felt compelled to write a book for the Yemeni people, trying to convey their message to the world because they deserve to be heard.
Catherine Shakhdam, I want to go back to the division of Yemen between the north and the south, because there was the Yemeni Socialist Party. It was a political party in Yemen, a successor of Yemen's National Liberation Front. It was the ruling party in South Yemen. It declared itself to be a Marxist-Leninist party, and then it went through a series of changes over the years. And then, of course, in 1990, the two Yemens united. Talk about that part of the history of the struggle of the people of Yemen, because it was part of the broader pan-Arabism that was dominant starting in the late 50s, and then became more radical, more socialist, more communist in the 60s and early 70s, and then, of course, went through a period of extreme decline. And then after the dissolution of the socialist bloc countries, again, in the late 1980s and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1990, 1991, that whole vision of Yemen changed. Talk about how, if that part of the movement has impacted or imprinted its political message in some way, in some new manifestation, in the current struggle of the Houthis against the Saudi invasion, the Saudi bombing campaign, and for independence of Yemen.
Well, the very interesting thing is that if you recall, if you go back to 2012 and when there was this, you know, national dialogue conference established in Yemen to kind of, you know, figure out the way to transition Yemen towards democracy following the you know, fall of President Ali Abdullah Saleh, the Houthi movement, you know, then was called Ansar Allah, the political entity, were actually quite friendly, you know, with the Southern Secessionist movement because they understood each other. They understood the need to have freedom. They understood the need for a democracy. They understood the need for, popular legitimacy. And they were actually, you know, even though they wanted to see very different things happen, there was a bridge there. There was an understanding that what they wanted were the same thing because they had lived under oppression, you know, under state oppression. The thing that happened is that the Saudi actually played, you know, one faction against the other by promising, you know, them different things. And what they've done is, you know, divide to conquer, which the Saudi are really good at. And what they've done is they slowly kind of, you know, brokered different alliances within the Southern Secessionist movement, trying to play, you know, personal ambitions against one another. And so what you had is that what you have today is a very fractured, and I would say they kind of lost direction because, you know, they all know that secession is very unlikely to happen. So the wind was literally taken off their sail and they did not know what to do. They didn't know what to react against because, again, they were fighting for many years against the regime of Ali Abdullah Saleh. This was gone. And so, they almost lost their identity. They did not know what to do. And so Hadi came and kind of gave them a second, I would say, a second life, because then they found themselves, you know, living in reaction to the Houthi movement, because the Houthi movement aligned itself with Ali Abdullah Saleh because they wanted to survive, quite frankly, and they understood that he was the key to the independence, as insane as that sounds. You know, the former enemy become the new ally against a greater enemy, Saudi Arabia. And that's the reality. The crazy thing is that the Southern Secessionist movement lost during the war in 1994 because Ali Abdullah Saleh made a deal with Saudi Arabia against the South. He promised to open Yemen to Wahhabism should the Saudi withdrew their support from Southern Yemen and actually help militarily and financially Northern Yemen to invade and basically oppress Southern Yemen and force them to unify under the rule of Ali Abdullah Saleh. So you can see that Yemen is a country which has suffered a great deal of betrayal, where people have flipped alliances. They have, you know, just because they it was, you know, for them, it was just personal gain. And, you know, we have very few people in Yemen who actually want to see something happen for the sake of the country. You know, it's very difficult to find in Yemen. And I think that's what has been lacking so far. There is not this one figure which has been able to kind of rally the troops around, you know. And today you have, you know, I know that people don't like him very much because he's not very well known. They don't understand him. But Abdelmalek al-Houthi has become that person. He has become this catalyst for popular legitimacy, where people understand where he comes from, because his family, you know, personally suffered a great deal under the regime of Abdullah Saleh. And they understand the hatred that they carry for Saudi Arabia because they want independence.
Catherine, we have about 2 minutes. How would you characterize the Houthis from a political point of view on the political spectrum, from right to left? Where do you place them?
I would say they're a nationalist movement, you know, angling towards socialists, because what they're trying to do is to create a republic with a socialist undertone, where they want to see the people be empowered. You know, you have to remember that this comes from the fact that they're a tribal movement initially. And the tribes in Yemen, you know, have a very kind of, it's almost a populist movement where they want to empower the people. They want to make sure that the people get what they want, what they need. And, you know, they have kind of transposed this into the, you know, their policies. But, you know, again, remember, they are very young, you know, politically. They only became a reality in 2012, even though they've kind of been around for much more than that since 2004. But it's just, you know, I would say they're tipping their toes right now in the political waters, and they are trying to find their balance. But they, you know, they're definitely nationalists, but they're not Islamists at all. They're not trying to sell Islam as a political model. So they're very, very different from the Muslim Brotherhood or from the Salafi movements, the Wahhabis. You know, I would say they're closer to the Nasserist movement than they are from the Muslim Brotherhood.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking with Catherine Shakdam. She's the author of a new book, A Tale of Grand Resistance, Yemen, the Wahhabi, and the House of Saud. You can go to Amazon.com to get the book. Catherine will bring you back soon. That's all the time we have. We will be back Monday. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.